Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show on CBS Sports Radio.
Yesterday was Veterans Day. It was observed around the country yesterday and today. And with that in mind, I do want to take a moment. I want to take one moment and I want to thank those who have served, those who are currently serving, and those who have made the ultimate sacrifice. I say this every year at this time. It remains true. I will say it again next year at this time. There is nothing that we can do to repay you, honor you as much as you deserve. So thank you to all of you. And I want to make that very clear, abundantly clear on this Monday and on Veterans Day as well. All right, turning to the NFL, another busy NFL weekend means there's lots of different places where I might start. And I'm always charged with trying to figure out exactly where to go, where to start. What do I do today? Is it with the Rams, dealing with everything off the field, handling business on the field, and dropping an amazing new audible?
He has jumped up to
Halle Berry. Halle Berry.
He has jumped up to
I could start right there. Or I could start with Aaron Donald looking to rumble after that game. Or maybe I start with the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles appearing to fall apart right before our eyes. They got punked last night by the Cowboys. Maybe I start with Khalil Mack bouncing back after missing a couple of weeks to record a couple of sacks. Don't look now, but the Bears are on top of that division. Or maybe I start with the Saints smashing the Bengals. I could start in any of those places. All would be good, but to me, the no-brainer is you start in Nashville, where Tennessee hammered the Patriots 34-10. A 24-point blowout, and I'm still not sure that it was even that close. Tennessee attacked New England. They went right after Stephon Gilmore, like they were looking to prove a point. Oh, that's your best corner. Yeah, well, we're going to humiliate that guy. And they did. And that was not the only humiliating moment for the Patriots. There was the fact that the Titans' defense kept the Patriots' offense under wraps for most of the game. They consistently confused the Pats. And that Bill Belichick had no choice but to wave the white flag by pulling Tom Brady from the game when there was no chance of winning. Did you ever think you'd see that? Or how about when they broke out this play on 3rd and 7?
Left foot forward for Brady. Waits on the snap and he takes it. A give to White. He starts to his left, flips it to Edelman, who throws it right for Brady. Makes the catch, stumbles at the 40, and he dives close to the first down marker with Woodyard covering up for Tennessee. And Tom Brady makes the catch on the reverse and then the wide receiver pass, but he stumbled toward the first down marker, unable to get there.
Hey, at least he caught it this time.
Yeah, I guess. He's got that going for him, which is nice. The good news is Tom Brady became the oldest player since Jerry Rice to catch an NFL pass. The bad news is he looked like the oldest man on earth when he caught that pass and started to run. He had nothing but green space in front of him, and then he face-planted. The Patriots just keep running that same play, and they keep getting the same results, don't they? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a good play. He generally is wide open. He just can't catch it or run with it when he does catch it, but they keep calling it. I mean, the Patriots really, really want to get the ball to Tom Brady in space, and for the life of me, I have no idea why. Just like I will never understand why a guy who is so careful and so methodical and so good with his footwork in the pocket looks like a baby giraffe wearing clown shoes outside of the pocket. The most accomplished quarterback in NFL history can barely put one foot in front of the other without falling over. And if falling on his face was not embarrassing enough, the Titans then came through with some real salt for his wounds.
Titans take over on downs from their 42. A handoff to Lewis. It's a reverse pass as he gave it up to Jennings, who threw it left-handed to Mariota. And he runs it across the 30, the 40-yard line of the Patriots, tackled at the 38.
Wow.
As the Titans gave the Pats a taste of their own doing.
Vrabel rubbing it in.
The same play the Patriots ran with Tom Brady
on
the previous series.
It's a great call.
Yeah, it's a great call, and it worked. They busted out a pass to the quarterback of their own, and it worked. They busted it out, except they ran it so much better because their quarterback can run so much better. I mean, that was not a horror show when he caught that ball. That instead was a first down, and that was an edge to the Titans. They had an edge. Maybe because so many of those Titans are former Patriots, and all those former Patriots showed up. Malcolm Butler, there was so much about him going into that game, about how he got left out of the Super Bowl, about how he was not having a good year. Well, he showed up yesterday, right? No catches allowed. Another former Pat, Logan Ryan, 7-yard sack in the first half, a huge pass breakup on fourth down in the second half, Josh Klein doing work on the offensive line, and then Deion Lewis. Deion Lewis had 68 yards. I've said it before, I'll say it again. There is nothing more tired than that so-called revenge game. But yesterday was a revenge game. Not that Titans head coach and former Patriot Mike Vrabel was going to admit it. He didn't need to, though, because Deion Lewis did. He played it cool throughout the entire week, but then he dropped an absolute anvil on the Pats after the game.
I didn't have to prove anything. I know I could play. Just let our team know that these guys are beatable. You just got to take it to them and be physical, and we'll wear them out. I played there, so I know those guys, and I know that if you be physical with them and let them have it, they'll fold.
Damn. Saying that he knows the Pats and that if you're physical with them, they'll fold is something else now. That's something else. I mean, he has called them soft, straight up. He called them soft. He didn't use that word, but he called them soft. That's the type of thing that you never hear with regards to the Patriot way. But then again, I know why Lewis feels that way. He had a big year for them last year. He had more than 1,100 yards for the Patriots and yet was still allowed to walk in free agency. He had another thought when he was asked if that game was personal to him.
Hell yeah, it's personal. That's what happens when you go cheap. You get your ass kicked.
Uh-oh! Quote, hell yeah, it's personal. When you go cheap, you get your ass kicked. There it is, your quote of 2018. When you go cheap, you get your ass kicked. And the Patriots did get their ass kicked, brutally. But the quote itself is probably worse than that beating that they took on the field and on the scoreboard, 34-10. That's incredible. Again, something you would never, ever hear with regards to the Patriot way. I mean, the Patriot way is about this. It's about getting rid of guys a little bit too early as opposed to a little bit too late. This time, though, those guys they got rid of, and not just players, but coaches, those guys came back and punched them in the face repeatedly, and then they talked junk about it. Listen to me now and remember it. Hey, you know that phrase, generally, that you get what you pay for? You always get what you pay for. Yeah, well, Deion Lewis has kind of reframed that and has turned it around. Instead of saying you generally get what you pay for, you say when you go cheap, you get your ass kicked. That's better than you get what you pay for. When you go cheap, you get your ass kicked. And let me tell you something. That trick play may have worked. There was nothing gimmicky about that beatdown. There was nothing lucky about that beatdown. They straight up kicked their ass. And they beat them in every single phase. They were beaten down, outclassed, outplayed, outcoached. They got worked. And that's a bad loss, not just because of the guys who laid it on them, but that may cost them the top seed overall in the AFC, because all of a sudden now you're two games back in Kansas City with only six games to play. You may have the tiebreaker, but it's not going to matter. Not two games back with six games to play. There was nothing gimmicky about that beatdown. They got hammered. 1-800-636-8686. How good do you think that must have felt? I know it did to Lewis. He just said a point blank. You go cheap, you get your ass kicked. I know it did to Malcolm Butler, who had a great game. You know it did to Mike Vrabel, who ultimately had eight great years with the Patriots, only to get traded to Kansas City and admitted that that led to some strained relations between he and the Hood. Man, that had to feel good. That had to feel good. Dear Rome, I think Tom Brady looks graceful when running after a reception. Signed, Albert Pujols legging out another ground out. John in Huntington Beach. Hey, John, I don't remember you getting your email read first on any day on this show. Let's hope that never happens again. That's not the guy that I want setting the tone. Hey, Jim, the Eagles look great since shocking the world and winning a title. Regards, Buster Douglas. As great as that was, what Philadelphia did last year, that was still not the same as beating Mike Tyson as a 40-1 underdog in the middle of the night. That, to me, was one of the greatest upsets ever. When I look back on my entire career of talking sports, that story right there is one of the most shocking things I've ever seen. Way more shocking than Philadelphia losing their starting quarterback in winning the Super Bowl last year. Even as long as it had been since Philly won a world championship, that even to me does not compare to the shock in Buster Douglas when nobody gave him any chance whatsoever knocking out Mike Tyson. Rome, I told you Matt Barkley would be one hell of a quarterback in the NFL. Regards, 2012. The Jets can make anybody look like a good quarterback. The Jets made Matt Barkley look like Jim Kelly
Friday's
yesterday.
Friday's Daily Jungle John is repped by Ferguson. War.
Listen
what do you
to
mean?
This. No matter how big what or you small mean? Your team is,
Ferguson.
You know, I said it over the weekend with regards to Jason Garrett. I'm not looking to get anybody fired. It's not my style.
Parts,
I don't want somebody doing it to me. And I would never misuse the form that I have or the microphone that I have. I'm not looking to do that.
Ferguson.
The only thing keeping Todd Bowles, I think, employed this morning is that the Jets have nobody else to go to within. Because there's no way you have the Buffalo Bills, one of the worst offenses ever. Literally, one of the worst offenses ever. Come into your house and hang 41 on you and think that you're going to keep your job. And I think the reason he is they've got nobody else to give it to. Monday's Daily Jungle is brought to you by Bethesda Game Studio. The award-winning creators of Skyrim and Fallout 4, they welcome you now to Fallout 76, the online prequel where every surviving human is a real person. Work together or not to survive. Under the threat of nuclear annihilation, you will experience the largest, most dynamic world ever created in the legendary Fallout universe. Reclamation Day 2102. 25 years after the bombs fall, you and your fellow vault dwellers, chosen from the nation's best and brightest, emerge into post-nuclear America. You can play solo, or you can join together as you explore, quest, build, and triumph against the wasteland's greatest threats. Fallout 76 will be available worldwide on Wednesday, November 14th. Pre-order now at participating retailers and play the beta. Games play best on Xbox One. At PJ and the Mile High tweets, there is no better way to start the week than honoring real Patriots, followed by breaking down the beatdown of the NFL's Patriots. There is something to be said about that. I mean, you want to talk about a real Patriot? A real Patriot, to quote a real Patriot, Pat Tillman. He used to be fond of saying that was a nice, swift ass-kicking. And that's what Tennessee laid on New England. Joining me right now to talk about that and some other action from around the weekend is an NFL insider for CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. He is the co-host of the Be More Opinionated podcast. My man is playing right through. JLC, how are you? Great to have you.
I'm doing well, buddy. How are you?
Jason, I'm great. Sorry about the technical difficulties, but you are
no worries.
And a legend for working through it. Listen, a ton to unpack from yesterday. I saw you in the morning. I came back here, and then a lot happened between now and then. Why don't we start with the Titans and the Patriots? What did Tennessee show you offensively and defensively in laying that beat down on the Pats?
Well, I mean, look, I've been a bit of a Marcus Mariota skeptic. He obviously has played through and with and around a lot of injuries in his brief career, and now that hand seems to be all the way back and he's unencumbered, you see a lot more touch on his passes. He's throwing these kind of rainbow moon balls he's putting right in the breadbasket of his receivers a lot of times to the outside, so they're cutting down on the chance of turnovers. That ball's either going to be caught by his guy or it should go harmlessly out of bounds. I'm not all rah-rah Titans now. They could lose to the Colts next week, and all of a sudden the Colts will be the sort of wild card team du jour who everybody's looking at to make a move. They've quietly won three in a row. You know, I think this is sort of who Tennessee is. I think they could, if everything comes into place and they play their tails off, you know, in a fairly watered-down AFC, I think they could play with anybody. They could also get beat 21-0 by Baltimore at home and look like, you know what I mean? It's look like it was one-way traffic the other way. So I just think you look at Baltimore, Cincinnati, Miami, Tennessee, Indianapolis. One of those teams is probably the second wild card. I just don't know what that gets you in January. Maybe a beatdown.
Jason locking for my guest. All right, so what about the Pats? Is this sort of who the Pats are? For instance, they've looked like the Patriots for most of the season, but there have been a few times where they've thrown some real clunkers. So is this just a one-off that'll happen every now and then, especially if you don't have Gronk, or is it something to be legitimately worried about?
No, I think it's more of a one-off. They're going to win that division. They're going to win that division going away. you know, we'll see if the Chiefs, you know, if the Chiefs are able to stay on this magical run. Does Andy Reid rest some guys down the stretch? You know, do they lose a game or two and all of a sudden, you know, the Patriots are, you know, still have a chance to get home field. I'm not going to freak out about them just yet. They kind of stumbled into this bye a little bit. It was a deep bye in the season for them with all the injuries and guys in and out of the lineup and everything else. I think it comes at a good time for them to adjust. And we'll see if they can get, you know, Edelman and Gronk and Gordon and Sony all on the field for any extended period of time. You know, I think that's a very formidable offense. Defense, we know what they do, right? They let you move between the 20s and they try to clamp you down in the red zone. And that's generally been good enough. But if the offense slips a little bit, you know, then it may not be good enough. But they're going to be playing in January. We know that much.
Jason Lockenfora joins us. All right, so let me get your thoughts on a few coaching situations, starting with the Browns. They look good yesterday. They look really good.
Yeah.
In fact, did they look good enough, Jason, that there's any chance at all that Greg Williams could actually be a legitimate candidate to keep that job?
Oh, they're going to interview him. I mean, I have a hard time seeing the process play out without him meriting an interview. And then the question will be, who else is in the mix? Baker Mayfield makes this an incredibly intriguing proposition, but the Haslams have had very difficult times attracting top candidates, getting people to take those jobs, and their decision-making process has largely been flawed. I mean, they had everybody in their building and all their analytics people and all the people they pay to make these decisions say draft Bridgewater. He took Manziel. They had all the same processes and people saying, everything we're doing here points to Sean McDermott. They said, that's great. Thanks for your help. We're going to go hire Hugh Jackson and keep him around a year and a half longer than we should have. So, I don't know, Jim. I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical of the idea that they're going to have, you know, Lincoln Riley and all the top hot coaching candidates dying to come and ply their, you know, trades in the NFL for the first time under the Haslams. We'll see. But Greg Williams is a way of connecting with owners. You know, he spent a lot of time coaching in Tennessee back in the day. Jimmy Haslam's a Tennessee guy. His brother's the governor of Tennessee. You know, we'll see. I think that team will continue to play all out, week in, week out for Greg Williams. And I think they'll win a few more games, and I think he'll merit consideration.
And he's already won as many games as Hugh Jackson did in 2 years as being a head coach there. What about the Ravens? You had this report. Now, they started the year 4-2, but they have lost three straight. What's that mean to John Harbaugh's future?
Yeah, I mean, he's got 1 year left on his deal. He took a one-year sort of kick-the-can-down-the-road extension a year ago. I'm told that will not be happening again. The Ravens are empowering a new young general manager, Eric DaCosta. The Ravens roster looks like it's primed for a rebuild, starting with Joe Flacco making way for Lamar Jackson. And, you know, would that coupling of that GM and that coach work long-term? You know, it depends who you talk to. But the bottom line is, unless they recommit to John Harbaugh with a top-of-the-market contract offer, and if anything, owner Steve Bisciotti's been ruminating the last 2 years when the season ended at his press conference about how close he came to making a coaching change, it's difficult to see a scenario where this team does enough that all these components are back next year. And Harbaugh will be, if he's available, the most hotly coveted coach on the market, I believe, especially if he can align himself with a quality offensive coordinator, because that's been a bit of a bugaboo for him. And you know, again, when an owner talks two straight years about how close he came to making this decision, and you're here at the pivotal bye week, and nobody's trying to extend him, and he's not going to do another Band-Aid contract, then, you know, it doesn't take Houdini to figure out where that thing's going.
No, it does not. Jason Lockenfora joining us. Jason, what about the Packers? They beat the Dolphins. They're 4-4-1, but what is your sense as to the vibe around that team, and in particular, whether or not Mike McCarthy is back next season?
Such a similar situation to Baltimore. Their young GM took over a year ago from in-house. Baltimore's is coming in a year. McCarthy and Harbaugh both have won one Super Bowl. Both have had trouble getting to the playoffs lately. Some could say personnel had a huge part in that. But nonetheless, you know, both did these one-year Band-Aid deals to get to this point. But now you're kind of looking at a crossroads. You know, Aaron Rodgers I'll go back to my report in week three or week four that there is some tension there. Those, you know, the coach and the quarterback, it's not quite the bond it used to be. There's been some concern over scheme. There's been concern over the staff changes that were made last year and who was let go and who was brought, you know, who was brought in. And they're having difficulty getting to the level that they're accustomed to playing in terms of offensive football. And again, that GM switch a year ago really is pivotal. And where is the long-term marriage going to be? And are they looking at Mike McCarthy as a guy who we want to recommit to for 5 years and say, you're our guy for the rest of Aaron Rodgers' prime? You know, or do they just have, like, again, it kind of started with Andy Reid, one of these mutual parting of the way, you got 1 year left on your deal. We know you're going to make a lot of money, so we're not going to owe you anything. You're going to get a job right away, and we're going to go in a different direction.
We're talking to Jason Lockenfora for another moment or so. I cannot let you go because it seems like you and I cannot talk this season without talking about Le'Veon Bell. With the deadline being tomorrow, JLC, is this the last time we'll be talking about him for a while? What do you expect to happen, and what's that mean for his future?
Probably not, because if he comes back, which I don't believe is going to happen, but until that 4 o'clock deadline passes tomorrow, you never know with this cat. I mean, he's up there in Pittsburgh. You know what I mean? He might be sitting there eating a tuna fish sandwich, working out, you know, shooting some hoops, working on his skyhook at LA Fitness, and decide, you know what, I'm going to play football. So I wouldn't entirely rule it out, but it's not likely. So if he doesn't come back, then we're talking about in a week or two, well, what's the future hold, and what happens if they put the transition tag on him, and who would make the offer sheets, and who wouldn't? When a player of this stature does something this unprecedented, Jim, I don't think it's going to evaporate just because he's not playing football. But I don't think he'll be back. Everything I've heard, and I've heard this for weeks, everybody's talking about the franchise tag and getting caught down in the weeds on that. They're going to transition him, and then we'll find out what the transition figure is, and then we'll find out if there's a team or teams that want to put together an offer sheet that would blow the Steelers away. Maybe it happens, but maybe it doesn't. There's a lot of time between now and late February, early March.
All right, so one last thought. Since the Giants are going tonight, as you wrote, a wise, long-suffering Giants fan floated an idea to you yesterday about the Giants trading for Jacoby Brissett in 2019 to address their quarterback situation. What do you make of that idea, and how do you see the Giants working that quarterback position next year and in the years to come?
Well, between us and now the rest of the world, you know that Giants fan as well. You probably run into him on Sunday mornings. His initials are TT. I like the idea. You know, I think for where they are, and if it turns out that the kid from Oregon and Tua they're in the 2020 class, and you want to look see at somebody for a year, and you're willing to trade a high two to do it, which let's face it, their two is going to be pretty high. Then I think Jacoby Brissett makes all the sense in the world. I don't want Blake Bortles. I'm not going the Flacco route. They need somebody with a little bit of youth, with a little bit of mobility, because the line still isn't what it's supposed to be. I mean, imagine, you know, Jacoby Brissett and Barkley and some RPO run action type situations. I like what I've seen of Jacoby. He's been trained by, you know, the likes of Josh McDaniels and Frank Reich. He's got starting experience. He's not going to come cheap, but it's going to be cheaper than Derek Carr. I really feel like he could be a really good bridge quarterback, you know, and his ability to boot and do some of the stuff that we saw Shermer do with Keenum in Minnesota a year ago, I think it could make sense. And remember, he got the seal of approval from none other than Bill Parcells coming out of college, and the tuna still carries a lot of weight in New York. So I think it could be interesting.
I think that would be interesting. Covering a ton of ground, Jason Lockenfora, an NFL insider for CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. Do not forget about his podcast. He is the co-host of the Be More Opinionated podcast, JLC. I will see you next weekend, Jason. Great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Look forward to it, buddy. Have a good one. Thank
you. My man, you're the best. JLC. He is such pro. Clones, give me 1 second so I can talk to you about my pals at Ferguson. Listen to this. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors with thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game. When the pressure is on, you can count on Ferguson. Yo, flight deck, when Keith Arnold comes in studio, pop Batman. The flight deck is on the board. Alvin DeLauro is in Italy. Alvin DeLauro is celebrating his 10th wedding anniversary. He is in Italy. Alvin, little Alvy, was going to Rome. He was going to Venice. Alvin, can I repeat that? Alvin DeLauro is in freaking Italy. Alvin's like one of those crazy cats where he'll load the family up in the minivan and they'll drive to Northern California and back in the same weekend. I mean, it's like the biggest ask ever. And I don't remember him taking any really exotic vacations. That's just not the way Alvin rolls. He is in Italy, sans kids, because who could afford to bring, right? Flight deck. Look at the flight deck settling in. Who can afford to bring 14 kids to Italy? Not Alvy, not anybody. Alvy and Mill getting after it. Getting nice. So the flight deck, it's an incredible week. Number one for Alvin, he gets to be in Italy, which is great. Once in a lifetime. And the second once in a lifetime opportunity, freaking the flight deck is here every day this week. And not only here every day this week, but running the board, sitting in Alvin's seat. So as a reminder, flight deck. When Keith Arnold walks in, pop Batman. Dear Rome, we think Melo's time in Houston was a smashing success. Sincerely, Dez Bryant as a Saint. Mike Price, coach at Alabama. Bobby Kremins, coach at South Carolina. George O'Leary, coach at Notre Dame. And Eddie Munster, head coach of the Orlando Magic. If that song does not put a smile on your face, I don't know what will. You know, like when you have a favorite song, you try not to play it too much because if you keep playing it, you wreck it. You ever notice that? Like you have a favorite song and then you put it on your workout tape or you bump it in your car and you keep listening and you keep listening and then it starts to lose something. So then you play it even more and you start to chase it and then it goes away and then you lose what once was, this amazing song. And even if you don't listen to that same song for a year or two or 5 years, it's still wrecked when you drop the needle down again. That's the Munster theme for me. Oh, no, I listen to that song away from work. I don't only listen to that song when somebody mentions the Munster Kid as coach of the Orlando Magic or the Florida Gators or OKC. That song will never be the same for me, which is kind of sad and depressing. Yeah, that whole Melo in Houston thing's not working out real well, is it? Even if they keep saying that it is. It's obviously not. Just like it wasn't true when Melo said, oh, I embrace the role. If they want me to come off the bench, great. Sure it's not, Melo. Like, he was going to embrace that role. In the meantime, he's missed a couple of games now with a, quote, illness. Whatever that illness might be. I would imagine he's not playing that much. He doesn't like that very much. And as they get healthier, he will play even less. All right, let's talk about how you felt this morning when you woke up. As an example, I went to New York and back. Felt great. Felt great when I woke up. Truth. Now, how were you feeling when you rolled out of the rack this morning? I mean, it is Monday. If you had yourself a weekend, maybe you woke up feeling a little punch drunk, maybe a little sluggish. Ever have those mornings when you wake up and you don't know where the hell you are? You don't know what day it is. Was today one of those days? Does the alarm ever go off and do you not know where you are or what day it is? Maybe today. Or maybe you rolled out and you felt like a boss. Maybe you felt great. Maybe you went right to the kitchen and you smashed up 25 grams of protein, you know, up and at 'em, ready to kill the day, ready to kill the rest of the week. Or if you're really fortunate, you woke up the way Baker Mayfield woke up yesterday, feeling the way he felt yesterday. Roll it.
And when I woke up this morning, I was feeling pretty dangerous.
Care to expand on that?
I just woke up feeling real dangerous.
Quote, when I woke up this morning, I woke up feeling pretty dangerous. Now, to me, that sounds like a dude who had a good night of sleep. That sounds like a guy who slept on a Casper mattress. Maybe even slammed a Zipa up into his gap. And it's an even better quote when you know that he delivered that in a double-breasted overcoat on top of a hoodie. Look good, feel good. Feel good, play good. Feel dangerous, drop a dagger on somebody. Great look, better quote. But the best part is, he says it, and he just stands there, letting the moment sink in. He even throws in kind of a little eyebrow raise and a smile like, what? What? I'm not trying to get anybody to look at me. I'm not trying to be funny. I'm not looking to start anything at all. I'm just saying, I woke up, and I felt dangerous. And when asked to expand on that, he just repeated it. Right, because there's nothing to expand on. Quote, when I woke up this morning, I was feeling pretty dangerous. It seems to me that speaks for itself. It does not need any elaboration. So if Deion Lewis had not verbally assaulted the Patriots, that right there would have been your quote of the week. And Baker was right. He was dangerous. He completed the first 13 passes of the game. He went into halftime with a perfect passer rating and a couple of TD passes. And then he dropped this in the second half.
Higgins and Duvall go out wide left. Landry and Callaway near side of the right. Duke Johnson, the running back. Mayfield shotgun back to pass. Baker throws. Caught. It's Duke Johnson. He's going in. Touchdown. And the Browns are right back in it again as they go down the field and score after coming up with the turnover.
Baker had a 151.2 passer rating for the game. The highest for a Browns quarterback since Brian Sipe. Are you kidding me about that? A Brian Sipe reset. Normally, when we're comparing current Browns quarterbacks to former Browns quarterbacks, we're comparing them to crappy Browns quarterbacks like Tim Couch or Brandon Whedon or Seneca Wallace or Spurgeon Wynn or Johnny Manziel. But you know, if Brian Sipe's name is coming out, something good happened. And it did. Something really good. In fact, in the last two games, Mayfield has completed nearly 75% of his passes for more than 500 yards, five touchdowns, and a pick. And he's only been sacked two times. All of the things the rookies are supposed to be struggling with, Mayfield suddenly does not seem to be struggling with at all. Earlier, but not the last 2 weeks. So if you're still having doubts about whether or not the Browns made the right choice in number one, you should stop having doubts as to whether or not they did. I know it's a small sample size. I know there are a lot of quarterbacks who started their careers on fire and then fell off really quickly. But the combination of Baker and this team, Baker and that city, man, it all feels good. It feels right. It feels unbelievable. It feels dangerous. But then again, he did wake up feeling dangerous. And the reason was because he was dangerous. He is. Better yet, let me think about this before I say it. Better yet, while he's dangerous, the Browns are dangerous. Yeah, I said it. The Browns are dangerous because it wasn't just Mayfield. It wasn't all Mayfield. That defense was nasty. They were getting after Matt Ryan, getting to Matt Ryan, forcing fumbles. In other words, they were doing what the 2018 Browns defense does, and the offense was feeling it. O coordinator Freddie Kitchens even broke out the wishbone. And Nick Chubb broke out the backbreaker in the third quarter. Roll this.
Callaway near side of the right. Landry in motion left to right. Mayfield under center. Second down and 10. Takes the snap. Gives it. Chubb runs. He's to the 10. 15. He's to the 20. 25. 30. 35. 40. 45. 50. There goes Chubb. He's to the 30. 20. 10. 5. Touchdown. Chubb-a-lubba-hub. 92 yards.
Touchdown, Cleveland! Thanks to Browns Radio. Second longest run by a rookie in NFL history. You want dangerous. So when you look at Mayfield and Chubb and the weapons they have at wide receiver and the talent on defense, there is a lot to be hyped about. There's a lot of danger in that team. Yes, I know they're 3-6-1, but they sure don't look like 3-6-1. They sure don't feel like 3-6-1. And the truth is, they're the best 3-6-1 team in the history of the world. I mean, I've never seen or felt the buzz off a 3-6-1 team like I do this one. I tweeted it again yesterday when the Browns were trending number one in the U.S. on Twitter. The Cleveland Browns are America's team. Let me say it one more time for the people in the back. The Cleveland Browns are America's team. They wake up feeling dangerous. They go to bed knowing they're America's team. And C-Town has got to feel pretty damn good about that. I know this. I feel really good about it. So my question, Cleveland, how y'all feeling about yourselves? I feel great about you. How are you all feeling about yourselves right now? Especially coming off that game.
When I woke up this morning, I was feeling pretty dangerous.
I'm pumped to talk some baseball. Specifically to talk some baseball with my next guest. He is a World Series champion. 1-0 with an ERA of 0.00. 10 strikeouts in 6 innings in the World Series. 2-1 with 2 holds, an ERA of 0.79. 13 strikeouts in 11.5 innings in the postseason. eighth in the American League in holds in the regular season. He was an All-American and a first-team All-Big West player at UC Riverside. And did I say a World Series champion? We are joined by Boston Red Sox pitcher Joe Kelly. Joe, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I thought you were freaking telling Nathan Eovaldi's stats of that World Series. I was like, whoa. Wrong guy.
That's great, Joe. Great to have you back, man. They all belong to you. That's your resume. Those are all your numbers. Joe, you've had a little bit of time for it to sink in. How does it feel to hear yourself introduced as a World Series champion?
I mean, that it still sounds, you know, like fake. It's kind of unreal feeling. Like, you know, I'll send shoot a text and, you know, people congratulate me and say thank you, you know. Or they'll be like, hey, what's up, champ? And I'm like, you know, it kind of sounds weird because that's I've always seen, like, as boxers or UFC fighters, you know what I mean? Like, you know, when they're the world champs, you know, people in movies are like, you know, to Rocky, like, hey, Rocky Balboa, what's up, champ? You know what I mean? Like, so I've got that. You know, I don't feel like on that level, obviously, but, I mean, the title is what it is. We are World Series champions, so it's pretty freaking awesome.
That's it, champ. Joe Kelly joining us. All right, Joe, so you enter game five in the eighth inning after David Price did his work through the first seven. As somebody who grew up in SoCal, what's going through your head when you come into the game in Dodger Stadium and you're six outs away from winning a World Series?
Dude, it was the craziest moment. So this was the situation. So it was, all right, we were the night before, you know, like, I come in the next day, I'm like, all right, like game five, like, you know, I'm hanging, you know, everyone's sore, everyone's banged up, you know, throwing every game, and, you know, the game starts, and I'm like, there's no way I get in this game, probably, like, you know, just in case I'm playing another game, I'll be fresh, like, there's no way, like, I'm throwing every game, you know, I've never done this, and then, you know, Alex calls, is like, hey, you're going to get the eighth, and I'm like, oh, my God, and then instantly, all my soreness, you know, aches, everything went away. You know, David Price is cruising. Like, nobody thought they were going to pitch. Everyone's like, holy crap, man, this guy's going to throw a CG. Like, this guy's going to just completely shut him out. You know, then he walked a guy. You know, coming in the game, you know, I kind of just enjoyed the moment finally. You know, everything leading up to that, you know, I've always been like, all right, I have to do my job. But it was like one of those things where I watched every one of my steps running in. You know, I looked at the crowd. I enjoyed the moment. Like, hey, this is the World Series. This is a chance for us to win the game. Us to win the World Series. You know, my best friend, my brother, you know, the closest guy to like who I am with on the team is David Price. You know, like, man, DP's killed it. Like, you know, I can't let him down. I can't let my teammates down. You know, just go in and I had fun. You know, that was the best I threw the ball, you know, all postseason right there. Punched out, you know, the next three guys. You know, came in the dugout and I got to have a special moment with, you know, my brother DP and, you know, just everything that, you know, the struggles that he's been through, the struggles that I've been through, you know, the commentary that he's heard, all the outside negative factors. It was one of those things where I could just, you know, give him a hug and, you know, tell him I love him. Like, man, that was so awesome. One of those type deals. It was amazing.
Joe Kelly joining us. Joe, that's an amazing answer right there. And for you to say that you went into that game and you were hanging, I mean, you were just feeling it, and then all of a sudden you get that call and the adrenaline kicks in. You want to pick up your brother. You want to pick up the team. And to do it in Southern California really is amazing. Can you kind of speak to what the World Series is like? Obviously, it's a totally different deal. But how different is pitching in the World Series as compared to the regular season or even the ALCS?
It's a different animal, you know. And I got lucky enough to have, you know, some experience, even though it was on the losing side when I was in St. Louis. But no matter how many times you go, like, play in the World Series, you could play there, you know, three, four times in a row. It doesn't matter. Like, every time you go, you know, you can feel it's a different ballgame. And people try to say, you know, oh, it's just another game. Well, it's not another game. You know, there's more people, first off. There's more media, first off. And, you know, the other team you're playing is not, you know, narking on any other the clubs in the big league. You know, it's not a last place team. They're obviously there because, you know, they won their side, we won our side. So the talent's there. You know, it's the biggest stage against the best players in the world, and there's only one game going on that day, you know, one baseball game. So you're thinking about all the other Major League Baseball players watching your game, all the other, you know, managers watching your game. So it's a huge stage, and, you know, that excitement and the adrenaline, like you said, like, you know, to come into a game like that with an opportunity, you know, it's nuts. And especially Dodger Stadium, you know, we play in Fenway, which is amazing, but, you know, Fenway holds what, maybe 37,000 people. You know, Dodger Stadium in the World Series, I think they hold, you know, 55. So it's almost like they're throwing two Fenway parks in one stadium, and the seats just keep going up. So, like, when I said, when I was running in and I got a chance to just enjoy it and look at the crowd, I'm like, holy crap, there's so many people here. I mean, there's all these movie stars there, and you're like, man, I'm going to try to show off for these guys and be like, all right, maybe come to the Red Sox fans.
Joe Kelly joining us. Joe, it seems to me you're a rare guy. You like that big stage. You like that big moment. You want to be in that situation. But Boston can be a really tough place to play when you're struggling. It's an amazing place to be when you're winning. How would you describe what it takes to be a member of the Boston Red Sox?
That's going to be hard to put in words, man. I mean, you hear all these things before you get traded over. You know, great baseball team, you know, tough media. Like, I mean, I've heard from guys that played in all the markets, you know, L.A., the New York, you know, Philly, and they said, you know, Boston is still number one, you know, when you're struggling to play. And I think that, you know, deep down inside, there's so many great freaking sports teams in Boston. You know, you got Patriots winning all the time. You got the Celtics who are back winning all the time. You got the Bruins who are making the playoffs every year. And then you got the Red Sox. And it seems to be, even if all those three teams win championships and then we don't make the playoffs, it seems to be like, the world has almost crashed down. Like, it's still deep down inside of Boston Red Sox are, you know, Boston. You know, deep down inside, they still, I think Boston is the number one sport. And it's cool to see when you're winning. You know, when you're losing, you're not performing well. It's tough because, you know, every person in that city knows your face. you don't want to go out to dinner sometimes. You're like, let's just go home and make some quesadillas or something. Like, you don't want to show your face when you're struggling. Just because you don't want to hear some guy getting off the train and like, hey, don't tell your bum. But when you're winning, it's a complete opposite. You know, you don't have to pay for food sometimes. You know, if you're going out to have an adult beverage, they won't charge you for that. Like, it's awesome to do when you're winning. But, you know, the attention is good, and that's what makes, you know, being a Boston Red Sox so great, you know, along with the history, but I think the fan base.
Hey, Joe, I want to say that you're never going to have to worry about paying for an adult beverage ever again in that town, but the fact of the matter is I think you know differently. Right now, no, but you got to keep doing it there. It's a tough, tough town, and it's a long season, right? I mean, you're going to have ups, you're going to have downs over the course of the year. I mean, you were extremely dominant at one point, and then you went through a stretch where things were not going as well, and then you completely turned the whole thing around once again when it mattered most. How were you able to do that?
You know what? I'm not going to say, you know, that I had a great season, but like you said, there were times where I pitched well, there were times where I pitched bad. And I wouldn't have been able to come back, you know, and pitch as well as I did at the end without the coaching staff we had. Number one, Dana Lavangia, our pitching coach, and number two, our manager, Alex Cora. Those guys, you know, we had little meetings throughout the year, but, you know, right before – like a week or 2 weeks, probably 2 weeks before the playoffs even started, you know, Alex was watching video on me, you know, Dana's watching video on me, and, you know, they brought me in an office and like, hey man, like, you know, we want to get you back to where you were. Like, we're going to need you big time. We're going to need you big time going down the stretch. And so like, Alex, as a manager, you don't ever see it really. Like, I played for a couple of managers and, you know, Alex isn't just a manager. He's actually diving into scouting. He's diving into, you know, if what guy's struggling on his team, he's looking at how to get those guys back and not just, you know, answering questions immediately. Like, he's actually, you know, doing so much work. So that was super cool to see. And, you know, Daniel Lavangia's like, hey, going into the playoffs, let's simplify your stuff. Get back to your old mechanics, get back to three pitches, and just throw the crap out of them. So we kind of tinkered with some stuff and, you know, ended up working out amazing. And, you know, like I said, I wouldn't have been able to turn around without the help of, you know, the coaching staff.
Joe Kelly joining us. You know, on top of that, Joe, you're breaking down tape with them and you're getting back to your fundamentals. But like, when you have a manager like Alex Cora, what about the start of the year where there was a moment where you had kind of a tough outing on opening day on March 29th and he came to you and said on April 1st, if there's a save situation, you're closing. I mean, he, as you said, he could have easily tossed you aside, but that's not what he did. What did it mean to you to have him say, you're still my guy, I'm coming to you?
Dude, it's refreshing and almost shocking, you know. It's like, I wanted to hear that, but then when I heard it, I was like, oh crap. Like, that completely surprised me. I didn't think you'd say that. Like you said, you know, I blew up opening day. Hit four, you know, I think I got no outs and I had an infinity ERA. You know, Chris Sale dominated. Oh, everyone's watching, you know, all the Red Sox fans, opening day huge. So, you know, ended up blowing that game and I just get hammered, crushed. You know, pitched the worst outing of my career on opening day. And then next game we won, and then Craig pitched, like too many pitches. So early in the year, you don't want to go to your closer, you know, as many times, you want to save them. you know, before the game started, Alex called me over and he's like, "Hey, man, if there's a save opportunity, you're going to be my guy to close it out." And I almost was like, going to ask him, like, are you all right right now? Like, are you okay? You sure you want me to do this? But I didn't. Like, that's just what I was thinking. And that instilled so much confidence in me just because, you know, it's easy. Like, it would be hard for me to do that even if I was coaching, you know, Little League. You know, like, a kid blows it, like, hey, you're still our guy, like, because competitively you want to win. But, you know, I ended up pitching well and got a save. And that's just the story of the whole year with every guy on our team with Alex. You know, trade deadline comes around. Everyone in Boston wants to get relievers, you know. All the media, fans, and Alex is like, no, this is our group. We got guys here that have proven it. We just got to get our guys going and performing well and pitching well, you know, and that's essentially trading for a new reliever. So the confidence there, you know, that helped our whole group entirely by not making a move. And then obviously we finished the year strong and won the World Series.
Joe Kelly joining us. Joe, speaking of moves, I mean, you're living the dream. This is unbelievable, but it's still a business. You're going to be a very sought-after player when free agency opens up. When you think about free agency, what kind of thoughts do you have?
It was one of those things that, you know, I love being a part of the team and, like I said, the coaching staff that we have. Like, it's going to be hard to ever find, you know, something like that again at a major league level, at a professional level, because it almost feels like, you know, your old travel ball days where you grew up with a team for multiple years where, you know, you stay the night at each other's houses, you know, you eat dinner with their parents. And on the Red Sox, it's kind of one of those things. Like, we're so close. You know, there's nights where we get, you know, 14, 15 guys on the team to play the exact same video game, and we'll play for, you know, 3 hours after a game. Like, we're just that close. You know, we go to dinners, we hang out, our families like each other. And at a professional level, a big league level, you know, it's not always the case where the families and, you know, all the wives get along. Like, everyone gets along so well. It's like one of the things where I don't even feel like a free agent, because I still feel like I'm a part of the Boston Red Sox. I still feel like, you know, that's where I'm going to be for the rest of my career. And when people bring a free agency, it's like, oh, crap, you know, I am a free agent, you know, and I happen to pitch well, you know, in the postseason, and now teams are going to want me to play for their team. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's still, you know, I just got back to California a couple of days ago. You know, my wife just drove in with our dogs from Boston. She made a long 3-day drive, which is, God bless her heart. So it's one of those things where we just got back, and, you know, that's not even really going through our mind. Like, after this phone call, I'm going to go outside and unload a U-Haul trailer filled with 1,000 pounds of stuff, unload my car that got shipped with freaking 500 pounds of clothes. So free agency right now is just me just coming back to California, just relaxing, having a good time with my family. And like I said, deep down inside, I still feel like I'm on the Red Sox, even though technically I'm not. So it's one of those things. It's going to be fun to see what teams are interested in me. And hopefully I can be a Red Sox, though, you know, for the rest of my career.
Joe Kelly, world champion. Joe, I got about 30 seconds. You got to make it back to OGs, right? You got to go to OGs, party like it's your 21st birthday, like it's the draft at the same time. You got to go back there, right?
Oh, you already know. My dad's already mentioned something like that. You know, they're obviously still in Corona and in the Inland Empire. You know, once we all get settled down, you know, I'm definitely going to have to go back to OGs, maybe talk to the owner or manager, be like, hey, man, I know you remember me. Sorry for making a mess of your place.
How about that Sunday night matchup? And call me right now, 1-800-636-8686. I did not take a phone call in hour number one. I would love to take one in hour number two. I don't have to, but I would love to. Last night's game. Probably nobody entered Sunday needing a W like the Dallas Cowboys. Maybe Jacksonville with their season ripping apart. But certainly like Dallas, sitting at 3-5, riding a 2-game losing streak. Jarrah's guys had started the week on Monday night by getting embarrassed at home by the Titans. Now they were going to end it by walking into the Link on Sunday night for a good old-fashioned NFC East rock fight with the defending champs, who had been looking much better of late. So there are must-win games, and then there are must-win games. This was the latter for Dallas. You're not going to get to the postseason if you start 3-6. Hell, Jason Garrett might not even get to Thanksgiving if things don't get turned around quickly. considering that the boys are in the middle of three games in 12 days, where 3-5 could easily turn into 3-8 in a hurry. Like Jarrah. Jarrah might love Jason like the son he always wanted, but even the most robust clapper in the state of Texas is not going to save his gig unless they get things turned around stat. So after an entire week where everybody was crushing America's team, including Hall of Famer Troy Aikman, one dude stepped the hell up, coached like his job was on the line. One guy, my man, Rod Marinelli. Did you see that Cowboy defense? Tough as hell. Their shovel was sharp. Their will was outstanding. They played like their season was on the line because it was. The Cowboys pass rush got the hell after Carson Wentz. They stuffed the run. They held the Birds to only 71 yards on the ground. You had young linebackers making plays. Leighton Vander Esch, Jalen Smith, freaking everywhere. The kind of thoroughbreds that you used to see running around with a star on the side of their helmet back when Jimmy Johnson was using that magical draft chart to fleece teams into trading them an entire wing in Canton for Herschel Walker. Like that. You want a crew to show up and show out? Rod's D did. They bowed the hell up. They won that game for Big D. They forced punts. They intercepted passes. They made huge fourth down stops. They weathered the storm. And then eventually it came back to the head coach. Eventually, Jason Garrett finally remembered he had a dude named Ezekiel Elliott in his huddle. You remember Zeke, right? The dude the Cowboys used a top five pick on. The one who rolled out his rookie year and won the rushing title. The guy Jarrah loves so much, he damn near brought the shield to its knees in defending him. You know, that dude. The one who had six touches last week in the entire second half. Turns out that dude, Zeke, pretty damn good at football. 19 carries, 151 yards, and a score. Six catches, 36 more yards, and another touchdown. Oh, and one amazing hurdle.
Shotgun snap. The give is to Elliott. Big hole at the 35. Elliott hurdles a man at the 30, stays on his feet at the 20, and scrambles down inside the 10, finally losing his balance at the 8. Ezekiel Elliott put on his Superman cape and took flight. Picks up 32, and it's first and goal, Cowboy.
Open field, head up with a safety, and Zeke goes vertical right over the safety. Literally. I mean, that was a holy bleep play by Zeke. Might have also been a holy bleep moment because the Ginge and his offensive coordinator, Scott Linehan, looked at each other and said, damn, maybe we give the rock to that dude. And then they finally got around to it. The last two drives, Elliott touched the ball 10 times. He also scored two touchdowns. Touchdowns they had to have after Philadelphia finally figured out how to move the ball on Rod's D. Yeah, I don't think it should take being pushed to the brink to realize that giving Zeke Elliott 19 carries is a good idea. Now, I'm not running out here to praise Jason Garrett for finally feeding the football to a guy whose signature celebration is, feed me the football. That guy should be getting 19 carries every Sunday. So I'm not going to go out and crown Jason for doing what every coach on the planet would have done like 8 weeks ago. But I don't need to because, of course, his surrogate dad, Jarrah, did it for me. Because post-game, Jarrah was talking about Garrett like he was Tom Landry, Jimmy Johnson, and Vince Lombardi all rolled into one. Check this quote. You can imagine the way Jason Garrett, his resolve before the game. I asked him before the game, are you feeling any pressure? He said, it just makes me want to go out and do even more to turn this thing. End quote. Only thing missing from that was pressure causes diamonds. Yet, like Jarrah couldn't have been any more proud of Garrett had Garrett been his own son. I think he wishes Garrett were his own son. That's fine. You can adopt this guy for all I care. Change his legal name to Jason Jones. Just do not expect Jason Jones to win anything that matters while he's your head coach. And stop acting like you just won the Super Bowl when you beat a reeling Eagles team that is one of the bigger disappointments in the NFL this season. And if you really want to hype a coach, hype the guy on the other side of the ball, Rod Marinelli. No credit for finally getting around to figuring out how to get the ball into your best playmaker's hands. And no, again, that win did not save their season. It kept it alive, barely, for another week. And how about those defending champs? Looking nothing like the defending champs. Yeah, but no credit for finding out how to get the ball to Ezekiel Elliott. Way to go. Nice job. Right now, though, let's talk some NBA. As promised, we are joined by a Cal State Fullerton legend. He covers the NBA for the New York Times. He has had a very busy week. We are joined once again by Mark Stein. Mark, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Really nice to talk to you. It's been quite a weekend in the NBA, so let me just jump right into this. What was your reaction, Mark, when you heard that the Timberwolves and Sixers had agreed to a deal for Jimmy Butler?
It's quite an everyday in the NBA. That's the beauty of it. But no, you know what? Look, this had to end. It had, you know, it couldn't go on anymore. It had gotten just ridiculous around the Timberwolves. I saw them about 5-6 days before the trade in LA when they played the Clippers, and it just, you know, the cloud that was hovering over this team was only growing. Everybody wasn't happy, and I think, you know, Tom Thibodeau hoped that they could play through it and they would win and be competitive with Butler, and that would mask kind of the, you know, the elephant in the room. But obviously it was going in completely the opposite direction. So I love it for Philly. There are no guarantees for the Sixers that this is going to work. But, you know, I'm a fan of big swings and being bold. And I think this is a very bold move for the Sixers. For the Wolves, you know, we have to give it time and see, maybe they will be proven right. But to me, this is a pretty disappointing end to a very sad saga. I just don't think they got enough. I think they could have gotten a much better deal from Miami had they taken what the Heat had put on the table about a month earlier. And again, maybe they're going to prove me wrong. Maybe Covington and Saric fit in fantastically next to Wiggins and Towns, but no first-round pick, no two-way player like Josh Richardson. I think it's a very, very deflating way for this thing to end from the Minnesota perspective.
Mark Stein joining us. Mark, I mean, they certainly could have done better. They should have done better. I see it the exact same way you do. What about Philadelphia in the process? For instance, Philadelphia is off to an 8-6 start, which is a little bit underwhelming considering the step that they took last season. For instance, if they were off to a better start, do they make this deal?
Probably not. I think they're a little jittery, not just because they had a so-so start, but, you know, the top of the East has gotten stronger. The East has been everybody's punching bag for two decades, and it's still, the West is far deeper. But at the top of the East, you know, look past Boston's early struggles. You know, they still have a loaded team with tons of assets. They're only going to get better. Toronto, so far, the Kawhi gamble couldn't have gone any better, and Milwaukee is finally playing to its potential. So I think the Sixers looked around and saw all that and said, okay, Paul George didn't even look at us in free agency. We weren't able to trade for Kawhi Leonard, and if he doesn't stay in Toronto, he's probably going to the Clippers. We're not going to have a shot at him. Let's trade for Butler. Let's not go into free agency again with no guarantees. Let's make a trade, get Butler in, have him for the rest of the season, have the chance to re-sign him to a max deal, see if we can make this trio work. I think it makes a lot of sense for the Sixers on all those fronts. Now, obviously, they're going to need shooting. They're going to need depth. The rest of their roster, there are a lot of questions. And the fit, will Simmons, Embiid, and Butler mesh? You know, especially Embiid and Butler, those are two very big personalities, but given the options Philly had, I love that they did something now instead of waiting.
We're talking to Mark Stein. Mark, one more thought about what happened in Minneapolis or Minnesota. I mean, Butler made it very clear that he did not want to re-sign in Minnesota. How much of that was about the money, and then how much of that was about his relationship with Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins?
I don't want to sit here and say the money wasn't an element, because obviously money is always a factor. But I think if Jimmy would have said, I want to stay here, he would have gotten a max deal in the summer. You know, they offered him an extension as soon as they were allowed to in July, but that number was based on Jimmy's current salary, and by going to free agency, he has a chance to make a lot more. The most they could offer him in an extension was about $100 million. He can make $190 million as a max free agent next summer. So if everything was going well there, I don't see why Butler wouldn't have gotten his money. But I think clearly he didn't want to play with Towns and Wiggins anymore. I think he wanted a bigger stage. I think he wanted to be around players that he thought could get him into the title contention mix with more assurances than Minnesota could offer. But, you know, it's a stunning turnaround for, you know, he came at, you know, Tom Thibodeau gambled everything to get him, gave up a big package to get him. They make the playoffs, they end this huge playoff drought with him, and for it to be over this quickly is stunning.
Mark Stein joining us. It is stunning. And then you've got the story of Carmelo Anthony. In fact, you have the story of Carmelo Anthony. You tweeted that on Friday afternoon, Houston announced details of a Carmelo Anthony Foundation event scheduled for Wednesday. On Saturday night, there are questions circulating league-wide about whether Thursday's loss at Oklahoma City was Anthony's last game as a Rocket, quote, end of quote. So he didn't play Mark on Saturday or Sunday. Where do things stand with the Rockets and Melo?
Well, look, the Rockets strenuously insists that he's still a member of the team. But I have at least two sources close to this situation who've insisted to me that Anthony's already been told that his time with the team will be ending in the near future. After the game, you saw ESPN, after their game last night, ESPN's Tim McMahon reported that, you know, based on the people he's talking to within the organization, people are operating under the assumption that Carmelo Anthony has played his last game in Oklahoma City, I mean, for the Houston Rockets. I would say around the league and around the Rockets, that is the expectation. Nobody expects this to continue, but Daryl Morey did come out and hold a little media availability yesterday and insist that the Rockets are not ready to move away from him. So I think we'll just have to see how this plays out. But everybody around this situation is saying it's over, and that the Rockets are going to go in a different direction. So that, I think, is still the expectation. Let's see how it plays out. The Rockets left for Denver. They play the Nuggets tomorrow night, and Carmelo Anthony is not on the trip. So he played Thursday, he practiced Friday, and now he's not with the team.
All right, so if that's how that plays out, Mark,
we're going to have to wait and see.
If that's how that plays out, excuse me, what were the Rockets expecting with the addition of Melo, and why has it not worked out?
Well, the one thing I do agree with what Daryl Morey was saying yesterday, I do think Carmelo has been unfairly scapegoated for Houston's problems. I mean, he is by no means the sole reason that they got off to a 4-7 start. I mean, their offense, which was one of the most potent in league history last season, I mean, was down at the bottom of the league until their last couple games. And, you know, that they've had the suspensions, they've had injuries, a lot of guys there just not playing up to their level. You know, Chris Paul's been playing with a bad elbow when he wasn't suspended. Harden hasn't been anywhere near his MVP form until last night's home win over Indiana. So there are a lot of things going wrong there, and it isn't right to just put this on Carmelo, but I think what's really happening here is Gary Clark is on a two-way contract and has really emerged as a guy that Mike D'Antoni loves and fits the Houston style probably better than Carmelo does. And, you know, he's going to get more minutes now. That would mean a diminished role for Carmelo Anthony. How is that going to sit with Carmelo? It was, you know, they already had to sell him on, look, if you come here, we need you to be the sixth man. Carmelo agreed to that. He didn't want to do that in Oklahoma City. He's been willing to be the sixth man there. But if he does stay, it sounds like his minutes are going to be way, way down. So there's really just no role for him right now, and I think that's kind of what's leading to all this.
Well, so, and then finally, is there a role for him someplace else, or could this be the end of the road for him?
that's the obvious question, and looking at it right now, it's hard to see where he would land, who would go after him. I have yet to hear of confirmed interest out there from another team. I know Philadelphia has been suggested because the Sixers do have holes in their roster after the trade and do need shooting, but it's going to be very interesting. If this thing has fallen apart with Houston, he might not have another option, which is hard to believe since he's only 34, but you know, this it's been trending in this direction for some time now. I mean, he's an an ISO. He's thrived his whole career in ISO heavy offenses, and teams in the NBA don't play that way anymore. So it's this might be it.
Mark Stein, my guest. Mark, one last thought before you go. Beating the Hawks, granted they are the Hawks, but the Lakers beat the Hawks. They're now one game over 500. I've got to get your thoughts. How would you describe what you've seen from the Lakers so far this year?
Well, the biggest thing is Tyson Chandler has, you know, I had a front row seat for Tyson Chandler being the basically the goalie, the defensive anchor on the Mavericks championship team in 2011. So I've seen Tyson Chandler at his best, and I'm a big fan of Tyson Chandler, but I certainly didn't think he would be able to have this immediate impact that he has had. And I mean, that already looks like a fantastic pickup that has really helped the Lakers on the defensive end, where they, you know, their two big areas of concern, obviously shooting like Philly, but also defense. And, you know, I think people look at Chandler's age and say 36, how much did he really have left? But, you know, I talked to one coach in the league last week who told me Chandler's going to keep doing this because, you know, these last 4 years in Phoenix have not been taxing on his body. I mean, there were long stretches where they rested him, and, you know, last season the Suns were openly tanking and Chandler didn't even play. So the Lakers, that would seem like a small move, is a big deal. And, you know, in the West, you can't get any further in the hole. Like, they got off to the rough start. I mean, the West is so deep. If the Lakers want to make the playoffs, they needed to do something early, and I think they found a nice little answer.
Good night now!